Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is December 21st, 2021, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Everybody Walk the Dinosaur and Not Take the Mobile Stroke Unit. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Howard Howie Mell. He began his career as a firefighter paramedic in Chicago. He became double board certified in emergency medicine and in emergency medical services. Howie also has a master's of public health. Welcome to the SGM, Howie.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
Well, your background in pre-hospital care, board certification, and master's of public health really provides an expertise to this topic we're going to be discussing today.
Well, not to beat my own drum, but the other thing that I did before I was in medical school was I worked for a municipal consulting firm called the Tri-Data Corporation, which did systems analysis of EMS systems, looking specifically at issues of vehicle deployment, staff deployment, budgetary constraints, and really tried to itemize things as to how to get the best bang for your buck. In your neck of the woods, we're a little notorious. I actually wrote the second of four documents, guidelines on how to make the Winnipeg Emergency Response Service into a true fire-based EMS service. But needless to say, there have been mired in politics for many years. But it will come into play as we discuss this particular topic today.
So, Howie, I also understand that you did a quality improvement project back in the day when you were a paramedic. And I think it was involving postpartum hemorrhage. Do you want to tell that story before we get jumping into the case for today's podcast?
Sure, because I think much like my experience doing systems design and systems optimization, it's going to come into play. Because before I was even, I actually never set out to be a doctor, but I was a paramedic who kept on showing up and they kept on giving me more responsibilities. But one of the responsibilities that they gave me a long time ago was we carried Pitocin on the rig in our EMS system. Now, this is a system in suburban Chicago of about 1,000 paramedics. And at the time, we were carrying Pitocin. And the thought and our protocol was there are a lot of home births that we might attend and there could be a postpartum hemorrhage. We should give out, you know, we should be ready to respond to that because it could happen. And so what I did was I looked at system-wide, so we're talking 1,000 paramedics or so, how many times had Pitocin been given out in the past few years? So I was looking at how many times Pitocin had been given out in the past few years. And what's interesting was when I looked at it, it had been used 4 times. Not a single time for postpartum hemorrhage. In fact, it was misused more than it had never been used properly. So it was misused every time it was used. A couple of times for severe pelvic cramping. One time for metamenorrhagia, another time we never did actually figure out why the Dickens, the paramedic, had pushed the drug. And so after we looked at it, we said, yes, postpartum hemorrhage can happen, but we're probably hurting more people than helping them by having Pitocin on the trucks. And we pulled it system wide.
Well, clearly I've picked the right expert to be the guest skeptic on today's podcast. So why don't you start us off with a case, Howie?
All right, so let's suggest that you are sitting there in your emergency room and you got a kind of tangential involvement in EMS and the mayor of the community stops by and he says, listen, I just heard a pitch from these guys. They want to sell me an ambulance that is a mobile stroke unit. They want to have this idea of a mobile stroke unit to respond to all these people having strokes in our community, and it's really going to help us. And I was hoping that you might take on a look at this, that you could tell me whether or not this is, you know, this is salesmanship or this is the right thing for our community.
Well, no one listening to the SGM is going to be surprised that we have covered papers looking at stroke. We've often discussed the use of thrombolysis for acute ischemic stroke with or without endovascular therapy. However, the SGM has also looked at secondary stroke prevention on previous episodes.
Now, the SGMs looked at pre-hospital stroke care using early administration nitroglycerin by paramedics to see if it would improve neurological outcome in patients with presumed acute stroke, which was SGM 269. The results from the RITE 2 trial reported no statistical difference in functional outcome as measured by the modified Rankin score at 90 days.
Yeah, the SGM bottom line from that episode was that the early application of transdermal nitroglycerin by paramedics in the pre-hospital setting cannot be recommended at this time in patients with a suspected stroke.
The issue of having a mobile stroke unit has also been discussed on the SGEM. An SRMA, which included 7 RCTs and 4 observational studies, including 21,297 patients, was critically appraised. The primary outcomes reported better neurological outcome at 7 days, but not at 1 day post-treatment by an MSU compared to conventional care.
So the SGM bottom line at that time was that we cannot recommend the use of a mobile stroke unit based on the available evidence. All right, so what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer on today's podcast?
Should mobile stroke units be purchased and deployed in your community?
And what reference do you have, Howie?
We've got the paper by Grada et al., Prospective Multicenter Controlled Trial of a Mobile Stroke Unit. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine this past year.
Yeah, the best MSU study. So let's run through the PICO. What was the population?
Patients calling EMS with a history of physical or neurological examination consistent with acute stroke who was last seen normal, possibly within 4 hours and 30 minutes, and had no definite TPA exclusions per their guidelines prior to CT scan or baseline labs. It was daytime hours and mostly weekdays.
All right, so what was the intervention?
Care by mobile stroke unit.
And what did they compare it to?
Care by traditional EMS, which they refer to as standard management.
All right, let's run through their outcomes. What was their primary outcome?
So their primary outcome was, now we'll talk about this later. The primary outcome is somewhat of a moving target because they changed it a bunch of times. But as published, their primary outcome was score on the utility-weighted modified Rankin scale at 90 days in patients who were adjudicated to be eligible to receive TPA on the basis of subsequent blinded review.
Okay, sounds complicated. How about the secondary outcomes?
So their secondary outcomes, there were 12 secondary endpoints in their final protocol. They listed them in order of hierarchical sequence of importance, and they're long and detailed and belong better in the show notes, and we'll kind of explain why as we go on.
Sure, yeah, we'll list those in the show notes. How about the safety endpoints?
So the safety endpoints, number one was the incidence of symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage, mortality up to 1 year, and incident of stroke mimics and transient ischemic attacks.
All right, and I did put a T on the end of the PICO statement, so it's a PCOT now. What was the trial design?
It was a prospective cohort study with randomized deployment weeks and blinded assessment of both trial entry and clinical outcomes.
All right, and so I'm going to read the author's conclusions, and it was, quote, in patients with acute stroke who were eligible for TPA, utility-weighted disability outcomes at 90 days were better with MSU than with EMS. Now, normally on the SGM, we run through a quality checklist on the podcast. I've elected to put it in the blog this time so you can check the quality checklist answers on the SGM blog. This year, we have added an additional question, and that is about conflicts of interest. And I want to be very clear. Conflicts of interest do not invalidate the study. They do not negate the study. However, they should make us more skeptical of the study. And Howie, you did want to say some things about conflicts of interest with regards to this area of research when it comes to mobile stroke units.
So Ken, you often ask about conflicts of interest. And I think that this one bears a tricky consideration here, because regardless of how this was funded, there has certainly been a giant impetus from many involved in the study and many involved in these trials of mobile stroke units to prove that they work. I mean, you have these very expensive units. You have this study that's been running for 5 years. And to a certain degree, with the huge investiture of capital expense to put a program like this into place, you have to wonder, does that itself become a little bit of a conflict of interest? Because you have built this gigantic kind of system and you're encouraging others to build it across the world. Are you really going to be as quick to report that the thing doesn't work as somebody who wasn't so invested in the time and expenditure that it took to put this up? Is it a true conflict of interest as we normally define it? No, probably not. But is it a conflict of interest if you look at human nature and how things go? Yeah, probably.
Yeah, there is a difference between financial conflicts of interest and intellectual conflicts of interest. But let's go through the key results here. This prospective observational study screened over 10,000 patients, and they ended up getting 1,500 patients enrolled, with about 60% in the MSU group and about 40% in the standard management group. 14% overall were not eligible for TPA due to intracranial blood seen on CT scan. Two-thirds in both groups were felt post hoc to be eligible for TPA. Of only the TPA eligible patients, 97% in the MSU group received TPA compared to less than 80% in the SM group. This result section was a real struggle for me, Howie. Do we talk about the primary and secondary outcomes that were published in the New England Journal of Medicine? Do we talk about the primary and secondary outcomes in clinicaltrials.gov or the current clinicaltrials.gov or the pre-specified published protocol? I mean, which outcomes are we going to look at? And I guess the cleanest way would be say what was published, and what they published was the score and the utility weight modified Rankin scale score at 90 days in patients who were adjudicated post hoc to be eligible to receive TPA. What did they find?
Well, they found that the score was 0.72 in the MSU group and 0.66 in the SM group, which gave them what seems to be statistically significant findings. But my challenge with that, they are still reporting out on a mean score. They're not reporting out on individual differences. So we have no way to know what the actual change was, whether this effect was because of the MSU, because of TPA, because of anything. All they said was, hey, listen, at 90 days, we looked at all of the people that were treated on the MSU, and they had a score of this. And we looked at all the people that were enrolled and treated on the with standard medical treatment, and we found their score was this. They offer us no commentary as to even a hypothesis as to why that occurred.
Yeah, the results section was really difficult to get through in this publication. And I think it's probably more important, rather than talking about some of these results, because we've given you the key result, is to actually get into the talk nerdy section, because I think that's where most of the conversation should be had. Do you agree with that, Howie?
I do. I mean, I think that the only thing that I really took out of the results section that is kind of a cross between their results and their talk nerdy to me was in a slight difference from their protocol to their actual results as they reported. Because as we said, they reported out what the mean score on a utility-weighted modified Rankin score was at discharge and at 90 days. But it's a subtle and importantly different statement than what they had said they were going to report on, which was the change in utility-weighted modified Rankin score from baseline at 9 days. But I think we'll get into that when we start talking nerdy here in a minute.
Yeah, you're already talking nerdy. Thanks for jumping ahead here, because you know, we're going to talk nerdy, and I usually have 5 points, but this time I had to expand it to 10. So let's get started with talking nerdy. And the first point is,
Houston, we have a problem.
I mean, they seem to have changed their protocol at least 4 times over the course of the study. These changes were described in the PDF of their protocol. Now, sometimes these changes were minor, but other times they were major changes. You can also see how their primary outcome changed on clinicaltrials.gov in their published protocol and through their published manuscript. I was unable to find any of the data in the manuscript or subsequent material on the 3 original or current primary outcomes. This included the kappa value for the agreement between the on-site vascular neurologist and the remote vascular neurologist. The second thing was cost effectiveness, so maybe that'll be coming out in a separate publication. And then finally, the change in the utility weight modified Rankin scale from baseline to 90 days. And there will be more discussion about this change in the utility weighted modified Rankin score later in this section. But all of these changes, it just left me with an impression, Howie, that I needed to be more skeptical of the overall publication.
Well, I think that they took this from a lofty goal that was going to perhaps show something that changed into showing something very, very different. And I don't think they actually realize what they've proven. The second issue here is in the hours of operation. And I already alluded to that a couple of times, but there were 7 different sites operating daytime only and not on Sundays. Most of our patients came from Houston, 77% of them, which operated from 8 a.m. till 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Wouldn't that be nice for an EMS provider to just have to respond to calls? But anyway, by God. These restricted hours and days of operation could have contributed to the fact that you only had 2.4 patients per week at the Houston site and 2.4 patients per month at the 6 other non-Houston sites. And you know what? There's a whole different point to make about this. But it's unclear if the data here really can be extrapolated to evenings, nights, and Sundays.
All right. Well, the third nerdy point that I wanted to bring up was about secondary outcomes. And this refers back to my first point. The secondary outcomes were also changed. The original 2014 protocol had just 2 secondary outcomes. This was updated to a total of 6 secondary outcomes when 4 more were added in 2016 on the clinicaltrials.gov registration site. Now, the published protocol with the manuscript lists 12 secondary outcomes plus 3 safety outcomes for a grand total of 15 secondary outcomes. Now, secondary outcomes should usually be considered hypothesis generating, but with all these changes made in the secondary outcomes, it's hard to have much confidence in the results and their interpretations.
Let me get to the thing that I think that they may well have proven, and that's the fact that we have an observer's paradox here, or the Hawthorne effect, right? This study is the observer's paradox personified. It was impossible to blind the ED staff or patients to the use of an MSU to transport the patients. And what's interesting is no outcomes were reported based on the treatment provided. In other words, they talk about how many times they gave TPA, but they didn't measure patients who got TPA in the standard treatment versus MSU treatment, right? All they reported on was the outcomes based on whether you were transported by an MSU or not. Now, that being the only variable, there's a plethora of variables from the Hawthorne effect, right? To the attention paid to a pre-hospital report given by a specialist physician or specialty team to the one given by a standard EMS provider. And what I think that they actually proved here, well, I mean, let's break this down. 77-78% of these reports came from one city with one EMS system as the control. And we have no breakdown as to why the patients treated in the MSUs did better, which makes these data very difficult to generalize. It's frustrating that they didn't stratify the data by the types of therapeutics provided, right? IV TPA, clot retrieval plus or minus TPA, IA, TPA, medically managed only. They didn't report any of those variables. But what they did report on was this idea that things got better when there was an MSU involved. And what this suggests to me as an EMS physician is maybe what they've proven is that greater weight is paid to a report given to EMS or given to emergency departments from specialist physicians and specialty care teams than they pay to the reports given to them by a standard EMS crew. And that, if there really is a difference in the outcomes, I think one of the things that has to be investigated is, are these reports, is this interface moment between EMS and the emergency department staff, which has been identified in many studies in EMS as a problem, is this just that personified? Is this really just another way of saying that we need to improve the handoff between EMS personnel and the emergency department? And I think that's a huge, huge question to take into consideration.
Well, the fifth nerdy point we wanted to talk about was outcome measure. The study outcome measure of utility weight modified Rankin scale may be a bit more confusing to some readers. I mean, most of us, we're familiar with the modified Rankin scale and even the ordinal shift analysis that is used in some stroke studies now. The utility weight modified Rankin scale translates the seven levels, you know, it goes from zero to no deficit to six being dead, of the modified Rankin scale to a value between zero and one. And the distances between the levels reflecting patient and societal valuation for each disability state. Now, the authors posit two advantages of using the utility weight modified Rankin scale over a dichotomized modified Rankin scale and ordinal shift approach. Dichotomization and ordinal outcomes result in a loss of information in contrast to this utility weight modified Rankin scale, which provides a way to use all points in the scale in a more patient-oriented way. Ordinal analysis also assume that each change between ordinals has the same clinical impact. The utility weight modified Rankin scale adjusts each ordinal to a more patient-oriented outcome. And to make things more complicated, different studies will assign different weights to each level, making it even harder to compare studies.
Well, and one other thing that's important, because it tripped us up as we were discussing things initially, they reverse it. So when you look at the utility weighting, it reverses from the modified Rankin scale that we're all used to, right? So we're used to the fact that six is far worse than zero on the modified Rankin scale. However, when you use the utility weighted modified Rankin scale, one is better than zero. So you take it from a high score being a bad thing to a high score being a good thing, which, you know, only makes it more confusing for the average reader to look at these data.
Exactly. It really can confuse you. And so, like you said, it goes from zero to six for the modified Rankin score, but for the utility weight modified Rankin scale, it goes from zero to one. And if you're in the utility weight group, you want to be number one. You don't want to be a zero. But on the modified Rankin scale, oh, I'd like the nice round number, please. I'd like to be a zero with no deficit, and I don't necessarily want to be a six and dead. So yeah, it is a bit confusing. And so hopefully with our brief discussion on this, and I'll put some more information in the show notes, people can get their head around that.
Now, I love, there is a very amusing table to me, especially from a nerdy point of view, that was included in this supplement. And this was their table, Supplement 5, Final Diagnosis Among TPA-Eligible blinded review and all enrolled patients. Now, what I find amusing here is that 16.9% of MSU-treated patients had their strokes declared reversed by TPA, whereas only 8.8% of EMS patients did. Now, that in and of itself, not so interesting, but then when you look at it, according to these data, only 0.8% of the MSU patients had TIAs, whereas 4% of the EMS patients did. It seems in the post-analysis, symptomatic patients seen on the MSU were cured by TPA instead of the more likely explanation that they would have recovered regardless. The other thing that is kind of scary to me is that in their post hoc analysis, they declared 7 patients in the MSU group ineligible for TPA and 2 patients in the EMS group ineligible for TPA. And all those patients got TPA anyway. So somebody went back later and said, yeah, we gave the TPA and we really shouldn't have. And there's very little discussion of that because and to me, there probably should be a little bit, because if we're giving people TPA that weren't eligible for TPA, we probably should look at that a little bit. Just me.
Yeah, no, and that gets into the 7th nerdy point. This is about protocol violators. The authors reported that close to 17% of those in the MSU group and almost 12%. Of those in the standard management group received TPA despite not being eligible for TPA. Now, these numbers of patients being exposed to a treatment in the context of a prospective cluster cohort study that has potential harm, and that potential harm is symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage, it would be likely that the number of protocol violators outside of a study would be larger, and this would lead to more potential harm. And this position that I hold is informed by the Cleveland area experience when TPA was first introduced. They published their results in JAMA 2000. They had 50% of patients deviate from the national treatment guidelines, i.e., were protocol violators, with an in-hospital mortality rate 3 times higher than those who did not receive TPA. It was 15% versus 5%. And so you really need to stick to the protocols to prevent protocol violation. And a study has more resources to do that. And then when you release these things into the wild, you get more protocol violators.
Absolutely. And that leads to this breakdown, right? So the 8th nerdy point is this interesting figure. And this is the consort diagram of all the patients who come in, right? There's a breakdown of the 1,492 patients enrolled. Now, mind you, these are the 1,492 patients for whom they thought that they were possibly having a stroke. This leads off all the people that they got who they weren't even thinking stroke, right? These are the ones that they were going to sit down and figure out, are they TPA eligible? Are they TPA ineligible? So on and so forth. Now, on this breakdown of this 1,492 patients, why were only 350 of the 430 TPA eligible patients in the EMS arm given TPA or EVT directly when 599 of the 617 or 97.1% of the TPA eligible patients in the MSU arm were? Now, I do not accept that IVTPA represents the best treatment for these patients, but it's certainly clear that the authors believe that. So given that, why the discrepancy? By definitions of the protocol, these patients were within the timing window for administration, so why wasn't TPA given? And I'll tell you, I think this goes back to further evidence that the ED staff responded differently to the MSU than they did to a standard EMS unit. And eliminating these differences should be the focus of efforts taken on the results of this paper, not expansion of the MSUs, right? What they've shown is that we in the emergency department handle patients very differently depending on who and how the patient is presenting. And that, I think, does give us some value in this paper. I think they've gone a long way to at least suggest that there is an issue. And I think you could potentially take these data and work them up, maybe looking at interfacility transfers when you have a critical care team involved, or traumas received, let's say, by a helicopter versus traumas received by a standard EMS unit, and how they're handled in terms of how emergency departments respond to them. But I think that's what I took as like an actual take-home message from this paper, is that there's this deep suggestion here of a problem in the handoff.
Well, my last nerdy point that I wanted to talk about was this change in utility-weighted modified Rankin scale score. No data are provided regarding the change in the utility-weighted modified Rankin scale score. This was one of their primary outcomes listed in the trial registry in 2018 on clinicaltrials.gov. Yet according to their supplemental material published in 2021, they changed their primary outcome on April 18th, 2018. The new version changed the primary outcome from this change in a mean utility weight modified Rankin scale from pre-stroke to 90 days to just the mean utility weight modified Rankin scale at 90 days. And it's confusing because they published their protocol in 2017 with a primary outcome of a mean utility modified Rankin scale at 90 days. And this changing back and forth for the primary outcome without publishing the results of the change in the utility weight modified Rankin scale increases my level of skepticism. One secondary outcome that they did report and relates to change in function is if there was a 30% reduction in the NIHSS score from baseline to 24 hours. They observed such an improvement in 75% of the patients eligible for TPA in the MSU group, and only two-thirds of patients, or 67%, of those in the standard management group. These data are interesting for two reasons. They demonstrate that the data regarding the change in degree of change were collected, at least for the NIHSS score, at 24 hours. But nothing is reported on the change in the utility weight modified Rankin score at 90 days. The other interesting aspect is the improvement at 24 hours in this prospective observational study contrasts the randomized control trial, i.e. the NINS trial, that did not report an improvement in the NIHSS score at 24 hours. This suggests to me that there's some confounding data going on, and TPA is not responsible for the observed differences between groups in the best MSU study. Now, you have one more point, Howie, and this is where we got the theme music for this paper. I was a little confused when you suggested, you said, hey, Ken, let's do this paper, and here's the theme music that I think that would really fit for this. And I went, huh? So tell us about the 10th nerdy point and why dinosaurs are important.
So there's a great line in the early scenes of the film Jurassic Park, and it's where the skeptic of the group looks at the head of Jurassic Park, who've just recreated dinosaurs from DNA.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
And any conversation of mobile stroke units needs to include this issue in the discussion. Look, this study ran for 5 years to get 1,500 patients enrolled. That equals 303 patients per year that possibly could have been aided by the intervention, right? We're talking about 303 patients a year that they said, yes, we think that they are having a stroke and we're inside of the window to intervene. So let's look at some of those data, right? If we look at 90-day mortality, the MSU was better in their study, was 3% better, or giving us a number needed to treat of 33. Improvement at 24 hours favored MSU as well, which itself is interesting as we discussed above, because neither NINS trials nor S3 showed any TPA benefit at 24 hours, but I digress. 7.2% more MSU patients were improving, or a number needed to treat of 14. If we look at the difference in patients with a modified Rankin score of less than or equal to 2 at 90 days, which is data that we have to kind of tease out of one of their tables, again, the MSU patients do better by 7.2%, so a number needed to treat of 14. Now, what does that mean? That means that if we took all 303 patients that were enrolled in the study, had received care of in an MSU, 22 patients of them, at least according to this study, would have better outcomes for it. And we can debate what exactly that better outcome means, but 22 of them would have had better outcomes for it. All right, so far so good. But what's the population protected by the MSUs in this study? What I mean is, we had patients enrolled from Houston, 807 of them, Colorado, 100 of them, Memphis, 54 of them, New York City, 28, Los Angeles, 23, Sutter Health in Burlingame, California, 22, Indianapolis had 13. So how many people, if they called 911 for a stroke during the study period, would have been eligible to be enrolled? And the answer is impossible to know, given the number of sites and the size of the respective cities. But let's use 1 million people as a benchmark. That seems more than fair. The actual number is probably 3 to 5 million. But if we accept that 1 million people, that 1 million person years were protected by these units, and 22 patients would have an improved outcome, which I'm accepting only for the sake of this argument, then one outcome was improved for every 45,455 persons in the population protected per year. Now, I was actually invited to be a skeptic at the 2020 annual meeting of the Society for Vascular Interventional Neurology, and I actually looked at all the previous MSU studies. A lot of them had much better defined populations. And what we showed was is that there was roughly one person treated per year for every 12 to 14,000 persons protected. And in Berlin, it was one per every 12,000. Toledo, one per 14,000. Cleveland, one per 14,000. And these studies focused on TPA administration. Best MSU focused solely on the mere presence of the MSU. And those studies, the Berlin, Toledo, and Cleveland studies, had a number needed to treat if you accepted their findings of 7. So they suggested that one outcome was improved for every 91,000 persons protected per year. Interestingly, if we accept a number of the best MSU data, that would mean 2 million persons were protected by its participants. And that certainly doesn't seem unreasonable. So what does that mean? Well, what that means is for the average U.S. EMS agency, millions will have to be spent to improve one outcome a year, right? If you live in a town that has a population of 91,000 people and you decide to protect your city or your town with a stroke ambulance, a mobile stroke unit, you will improve by the best conglomerate and the best possible reading, the most favorable reading to MSUs out of all these studies, you will improve one outcome a year. And so if you even take a small city in the United States, right, you're going to have to put your, where you're going to protect, let's say, 10 times that number, you're going to protect 910,000 people. You say, we'll save 10 people per year. Yep. But if you've got 910,000 people, you're probably geographically going to need at least 2 mobile stroke units. So again, we're talking millions of dollars per save, if you can call it a save, per improved outcome. And for the cost of an MSU, you could put an additional 2 or 3 regular EMS units on the street. And I would argue, and will argue, that you will save, legitimately save, more than one person per year by putting 2 or 3 regular EMS units on the street in your average city in the United States, Canada, or really any world, any first world country that practices ALS type of intervention. You're going to have much better outcomes in terms of overall population health. So the question is, can MSUs improve outcomes? Maybe. Probably not, but maybe. Is the juice worth the squeeze? Absolutely not.
Wow, Howie, that was a bit of a rant. Why don't you tell us how you really feel?
Well, I mean, but it's honest, right? Like, we know how we could get the best outcomes possible for EMS, right? Look at the president of the United States. I'm not talking politically. I don't care who the president was. Look at a president of the United States that has served in the modern era, let's say since 1980. They, everywhere they go, they have an ambulance following them. Nowadays, the ambulance has a nurse practitioner and two paramedics on board. They carry typed and cross-matched blood specific to the president. If anything happens to the president, this unit swoops in and starts to administer EMS. And I am willing to bet that the outcomes that they would be able to produce in any given medical emergency for the president of the United States is better than anywhere else that any citizen of the U.S. or Canada is ever going to get from an EMS agency. Now, that comes at fantastically great cost. So it would be impossible for us to literally put that level of protection in place for every person in the United States. But we know how it can be done, and if cost is literally no object. And so anybody who's involved in EMS has to take the stance of, how do I do the most good for the most people? And what I've told many of my crews over the years is, if EMS saves 95% of the people 95% of the time, it's the greatest public health invention ever. And chasing 100% with things like this, why stroke? Why not go back? Let's start putting, heck with putting Pitocin on the rigs. Let's put OBs on the rigs. As a matter of fact, let's get some C-arms and let's put orthopedic surgeons on rigs. We could save hospital admissions that way. All the broken bones just get attended to by an orthopedic surgeon in the field. It'll save us some admissions on Saturday nights in the middle of COVID. I mean, there has to be a line. And the MSU is way on the opposite side of the line of reasonability.
Well, Howie, now I'd like you to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusion.
Well, I don't disagree with the author's conclusion. I disagree with how that conclusion is interpreted in the paper. The paper does not prove that MSU should be in wider use. To me, it proves that the handoff of a suspected stroke patient between EMS and ED staff can be improved on, and that would likely improve patient outcomes much better.
Well, then give us an SGEM bottom line.
We still cannot recommend the use of an MSU, even with the addition of the best MSU publication.
And can you resolve that case where you had a mayor basically consulting you and asking for your advice about whether or not they should purchase an MSU for their community?
You mean after I'd whip out the whiteboard and draw out for him the rant that I just went on? No, I would tell the mayor that given the choice of spending the dollars on one MSU ambulance versus two or three regular EMS units, I would strongly advise the latter. It would improve not just response times for stroke patients, but in all patients who call 911. And if we got an extra couple of bucks left over, let's pilot some studies to improve communication at the time of handoff.
All right. Well, so how are you going to take this publication, this best MSU study, and apply it clinically?
I don't think we have enough high-quality evidence to support the use of MSUs, and I think these initiatives should not be supported by EM or EMS physicians. I think that we have to, you know, there's always been a groundswell of people who are very invested in these things. There is everyone from paramedics to non-physician providers to neurologists who have become involved in the heavy capital outlay and in the huge basically build of these things, And they are looking at this on social media, and they're looking at the fact that the author says this was a positive outcome. And they're saying, great, we've now proven MSUs yet again. And the reality is you haven't proven MSUs yet at all. I think what you have proven is something that all paramedics have been saying for years, and that is there's probably some improvements to be made on the handoff between EMS and the emergency department. And I think if somebody wants to wave this paper around and wants to honor the hard work, because I don't doubt that this was arduous to generate, and wants to say we should make some changes based on this paper, I agree. We should really be taking a strong, hard look at how stroke patients are received at our various institutions by EMS, how they're handed off, and how we can improve that handoff so that all patients, regardless of whether they're brought in by an MSU or brought in by regular EMS, receive what is felt locally to be the best treatment that a stroke patient can receive.
Well, usually we translate all of this into a conversation with the patient in a section we call, what do you tell the patient? But in this case, it'd be, what do you tell the mayor?
Well, I'd tell the mayor, EMS chief, or health system that MSUs are an expensive boondoggle that won't change the health of the population they serve. I'd point out that the study suggests there may be issues with the handoff between EMS and the ED regarding suspected stroke patients that could be improved on, and that would lead to increased favorable outcomes, not just for stroke patients, but likely for all patients.
Okay, it's time to announce the Keener Contest winner, and last week's winner was a resident from Florida Atlantic University. They knew the adult human body contains about 1 kilogram, 2.2 pounds, of calcium. What's the Keener Contest question this week, Howie?
There is a great documentary put together by the Emergency Medicine Residents Association a few years ago called 24/7/365, which actually shows you the whole history of early emergency medicine and how it evolved. And they managed to get on film many of the grandfathers and grandmothers of the profession so that they could tell their story. And so I'll send you a link to add to the show notes here. But why don't we ask, does anyone out there know who actually narrated that and what their connection to emergency medicine is? There's a famous actor that narrated that film, and what is his connection or her connection to emergency medicine?
Okay, so if you know who narrated that documentary 24/7/365, then send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. All right, well, Howie, that was a great episode. We got a little feisty there. Thank you very much for coming on and providing your expertise and helping me critically appraise this paper.
Did you expect anything less than feisty from me on this topic?
I did not. You're exactly as advertised. So thank you very much. There's only one final task that I request you do. And could you read the SGEM tagline?
Absolutely. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.